For Wednesday, April 18th, we're going to take the bills in a little different order this morning. We're going to take up 3420 first, and then go back to the top of the agenda. Which was it?
The other one was...
Do we have people here for that at this point?
Kevin Neely's on his way. He called me.
Okay, well, then we will go back then to the top of the agenda. Okay. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3420.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3420 comes to you from Representative Barker, requires the Secretary of State to regularly audit all county juvenile departments, at least four county departments, each by name except during the first by name, and the Secretary of State audit no fewer than eight departments. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I got a set of amendments last night, which I brought down to the Legislative Council's office, which would substantially reduce the number of audits and spread it over a couple of year period. You have Steve Gold here from Crime Victims United and several other witnesses who are prepared to testify in the bill.
Very good. Mr. Dole, and I have Ken Chapman also from Crime Victims United. Would it make sense for to have both of you come together?
Chair.
Mr. Dole.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm with Crime Victims United of Oregon. House Bill 3420 goes back to the passage of Senate Bill 1, refers back to the passage of Senate Bill 1 in which 1995 the entire juvenile justice system was revamped and created the Oregon Youth Authority, which was at the time just McLaren and Hillcrest, and took it out of the under the purview of the CSD and made it a freestanding agency. At the time that the bill was passed, the intro or preamble to the code was changed, and you have that in front of you. It's you see a document that says Juvenile Justice System Audit. At the back of that document is the preamble to the code, which is the purposes of juvenile justice system in delinquency cases and audits. This bill addresses Section 2 of that preamble, in which it says programs, policies, and services shall be regularly and independently audited as to their effectiveness in providing public safety and preventing a youth's return to criminal behavior. The Secretary of State shall select and oversee the auditors. Since the passage of Senate Bill 1, over the last 12 years, we have yet to have an audit of the system. Now, the auditors have performed several audits, and I think that is in excess of 10, I believe, of the Oregon Youth Authority itself. However, the system, and I'm talking about the counties now, where you live and where, remember, 94% of the youth in the juvenile system are. Only about 6% of them are in closed custody within the Oregon Youth Authority. So this addresses those youth, and Mr. Chapman will tell you a little bit about that audit. I'm not going to go through the long, tortured history of this thing. I think that Representative Barker, who's the sponsor of this bill, and particularly Vice Chair Wisnett, are very familiar with this. But from Washington County to Multnomah County to Curry County to Deschutes County to Marion County, I hope I'm covering everybody, this is going to tell us what's actually happening on the ground when we do these audits within the juvenile justice system, because we don't have that information now. And it will help you as policymakers create better policy and allocate resources better within the juvenile justice system. We have these late amendments that the council spoke to. We have had a long-standing, if you will, interim committee that's been meeting over the last 12 years. We've been through two governors, two secretary of states, three deputy secretary of states, three auditors, and I could go through the list. It's kind of like the movie They Shoot Horses, Don't They? But the constant dance partners have been Crime Victims United, Ken Chapman, Rick O'Dell from J-Bar J Ranch, who Mr. Representative Wisnett knows, and some others who have worked on this diligently. But the amendments that we have proposed will actually put the Secretary of State, and I want to at this point thank Chuck Hibner from the Secretary of State's office, the Audit Division, for working very hard with us on this, and the governor's office, in coming to these agreements. It will set up a system in which they will do audits for the next two biennia, and they will do a minimum of four counties in each biennia, then bring a report to the legislature, in which ultimately we hope that the data collection process will be turned over to the OYA, and then they will speak to this, and that the ultimately the auditors will be just in a position of checking the validity and auditing the data. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Chapman, and I really appreciate your time and hope that we finally get these audits started.
Mr. Chapman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also want to thank the Secretary of State's office. We had a very productive meeting yesterday that resulted in the consensus amendments that you have.
Mr. Chapman, just for the purpose of the record, could you identify yourself for
me? Oh, yes. Ken Chapman, and I do represent, in this case, Crime Victims United. I'm the Juvenile Justice Policy Advisor. Well, what we are attempting to do is something that which we know of no other state that does it. What we're trying to do is to find out what actually happens with kids in the system. Somewhere around 65-70% of all kids will have their dispositions determined by county juvenile departments. Only 18% actually go to the juvenile court judges, and even most of those stay within county juvenile departments. So what we're trying to find out is what is done and what is the follow-up. For instance, we would like to know, and we think it would be important to policymakers to know, how often does a youth get in trouble before they're put on probation, or before they're sent to residential treatment, or before they're sent to a secure correctional facility? If they're ordered into treatment, do they actually go? And if not, what is the response of the system? The juvenile department, or the county juvenile departments, are in effect a feeder system. At its worst, when they don't work, they're a feeder system for the state juvenile justice facilities. And what we'd like to know is if there's a way we can cut down that flow into the state juvenile justice facilities. So we're hoping, we have vetted this a number of times. The Secretary of State's office has looked to see if this information can be collected. Most of it can be collected through using the Juvenile Justice Information Service, and we believe that this will be important information for policymakers. I will not read my testimony. This is just the brief outline of it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions, Mr. Dole or Mr. Chapman?
Mr. Chair, I just would comment. Thank you very much for working with the Secretary of State's office to come up with a compromise on this that will work and to everybody's satisfaction. I really appreciate you doing that.
Okay. Very good. Council Taylor.
Chairman of the committee, Mr. Dole, I remember working in this bill in 1995. In fact, we probably spent about 100 hours on it, and I'm dragging my memory, and I remember this particular section. And current law requires the Secretary of State to conduct audits. Do you know why no audits have been conducted of county juvenile programs?
You know, I would say this. I'd ask you to direct that question to the Secretary of State, but I will say this in their defense. You know, in our first number of years of meetings, and as you know, this arose out of the governor's task force on juvenile justice, of which our current governor was one of the main drivers on, along with U.S. Senator Gordon Smith. We didn't have the JAJIS system up and running until about 2000, and really between 96 and 2000, while we had several of these meetings and ongoing meetings on how to attain this, it really would have been impossible for them to really get in and do these audits until we had this data within a collection system itself. Now, they may have further information for you on that, but I think that's one of the main issues that we had.
Mr. Dole, again,
Could you tell me what kind of audit you're anticipating?
This is not a financial audit. I want to make that clear. This is a performance audit, and it covers, again, you'll have in front of you document on juvenile justice system audits, which more fully describes it that Mr. Chapman alluded to. And you'll notice that it covers the three main topics are accountability, community protection, and reformation. And the reason we're using those three is because that's the three issues within 419C, the preamble to the code. That's what the code says that the juvenile justice system is supposed to do. So that's where the questions are focused.
Someone further question. Ahead. Mr. Joel, would that include recidivism rates too?
It includes reformation, and I believe actually
already did. If I could answer that, we do collect. There are recidivism rates now, which are published through the OYA website.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just real quickly, I do support this, and I hope we'll be bringing it back for a work session and get it on. I think it's very important to this program to have this done, so I hope we can move it through quickly after.
Okay. There are no further questions, then we'll excuse these witnesses and call Chuck Hibner forward.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division. I am providing written testimony, which I guess is more for your edification as to why the amendments that are being proposed are important to us. I don't feel a need to go through the challenges we saw with the bill as it was coming forward, but it might help you kind of understand why the amendments would be important to us. As you might expect, we have a little different take on history to date. I have a little different story to tell. We've been engaged in doing audits of OIA type issues, Senate Bill 1 type issues, since our first audit, I believe, was in 1997. So we've been engaged in trying to do thoughtful audit work, and this is just the next step. And frankly, when we went in 1999, went to try to do an audit of the system, there was nothing to audit. So we stepped back and said, there's nothing to audit. You need to get a system in place. Hence, JGIS. We did an audit of the Juvenile Justice Information System to make sure that they had the controls that were to be in place, or supposed to be in place, were in place. And then we went ahead and looked at the sort of data elements that were being provided out of JGIS and other sources in our next round of audits. And this seems like the next logical step. And as I explained to Steve and Ken and Rick when we sat down and met, you know, this is what we had kind of planned to do. You know, this is the next thing, to get down into the counties, look at grant agreements, look at accountability agreements, look at the data that's flowing into J, just make sure it's making sense, and some other, you know, tangential issues as we do this. So we have no problem at all with the way the amendments came together. It'd been nice to have this discussion a little earlier in the process. I hate scurrying around at the end. Being an auditor, you understand I hate surprises. So we like to have those things ironed out, but, you know, the process worked. In fact, we spent two hour and a half meetings, basically talking about how we agreed on what needed to happen next. So, you know, we're fine with the proposed amendments. We would support it. We would do this work with or without the bill passing. That was the next thing we had planned. So we're fine. And that's really the basis for the story, for my story anyway. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Hibner, is there experience with in other areas of state operations, the legislature telling the Secretary of State's Audit Division to conduct a certain audit, or is this kind of a one-off situation?
Chair McPherson, there are provisions in law that direct us to do audits. I'm trying to, you know, I know I've got a list of a lot of laws that we have to follow. There are a few in there that have direct audit provisions, like the change of director audits were something that came from a statutory mandate, where whenever an agency head needs to, or when an agency head leaves an agency, we go in and do a quick audit surrounding expenses payer. I mean, it's a fairly innocuous audit, but something that is prescribed in law. And Measure 66, which was a constitutional amendment, directs us to do regular auditing of those expenditures to make sure they're consistent with what's prescribed in the Constitution. So it doesn't happen a lot, and we do have to be fairly cautious and make sure we're talking to folks about those. Is there mandating things in statute? Because we are an independent audit organization, and I think you could see at some point if the statutes continue to direct our audit work, at some point we lose our ability to be self-directive. So as long as it doesn't get too burdensome, which I don't know where that line is, you know, we're certainly willing to discuss those things. And since this is currently in law, I mean, this is something that was passed in 95, being able to come up with something that adds a little more specificity and a beginning and an end to it would be helpful to us, because we see our role as the independent auditor out there validating stuff. And for us to be engaged in county audits from now until the end of time, I'm not sure is our role. We'll be engaged. We certainly will be there to verify stuff. We'll do things that we think are important. But we aren't managing this program. That's something that the state and OIA should probably be doing. We're certainly willing to be a force for change. We're willing to go in and do our best to provide good audit information as always. But at some point, this shouldn't be what we do. It should be us coming in after the fact and making sure things are working as they should be.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say thank you. Same thing. Thank you very much for working on this to get it so it'll work.
It's my pleasure. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Really appreciate that.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Hibner. I think this is very important work to be doing. And I noticed that it says no fiscal impact. Do you have existing staff to do this work? I know you said you were going to be doing it anyway, even without this staff.
Right. And Representative Bonamici, I think that's why we would say that under this construct. Under the what was originally introduced, it would have been a significant fiscal impact. But since we already can handle what we're planning with existing staff, we do have a percentage of our budget that is discretionary. We can devote to discretionary work, so there'd be no fiscal impact as the amendments are looking.
Thank you.
Yeah, I might point out that the bill comes to us with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so that would be the path it would be on. The way it's queued up, at least from the Speaker's office.
As it was introduced, it would have been 8 discrete performance audits of counties trying to get at effectiveness. It would have been a significant fiscal impact if we would have been trying to do effectiveness audits in counties, which, as you read my testimony, you'll see that presents its own challenge.
So let me understand what you're saying. So the effect of the amendments that are being prepared would be to eliminate that fiscal impact?
It would be the audits that we would be doing under the amendments would be something we'd be doing with existing staff and would not require us additional resources for us.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Flores.
Then a question I might have, since the staff measure summary that we have indicates no fiscal impact, but it doesn't anticipate the amendments or address them in there, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had a mix-up in staff last night, and I did the staff measure summary at a little before 5 o'clock. We did not have a fiscal impact one way or the other on the bill. When I looked at it this morning and I pulled the file off, it says prior referral to Ways and Means Committee. So as far as no fiscal impact, that's speculation at my part at 10 minutes of 5 last night.
So it will.
So in other words, we have not had the fiscal impact. When the amendments come back, we will send them down to legislative fiscal office and ask for fiscal at that time.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hibner.
Thank you.
Then I will, before I close the public hearing, just will urge all the participants in the process, since we're getting close to the end of our time working House bills in this committee, to move forward as quickly as they can, because we need to get our work completed within a couple of weeks now, or in fact less than that, within 10 days. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3420 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2736. And let Council Stanford introduce it, and then we'll let you make some introductory remarks as well, Senator.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2736 relates to the crime of assault in the third degree, a Class C felony. ORS 163.165 establishes the Class C felony of assault in the third degree. This offense occurs in several situations, including but not limited to the following. First of all, recklessly causing serious physical injury to someone by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon, or through circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to human life. Another example is while being helped by someone else, intentionally or knowingly causing physical injury to someone. Third example, causing physical injury to an emergency medical technician performing her job, to a child 10 or younger, or to a taxi cab driver acting in the course and scope of employment. House Bill 2736 adds a new category to the list, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing physical injury to persons enforcing city parking regulations or parks and recreation rules if those persons are acting in the course and scope of their employment.
Okay. Senator Barker, did you want to give us some introductory comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is pretty much covered right there. We want to protect the parking patrol people and people who work in the parks and recreation districts around the state who are sometimes subject to attack. This would put them in line with taxi cab drivers and so on to make it a more serious penalty if somebody causes physical injury to them.
Okay, thank you very much. We have three people from the city of Portland signed up. I want to suggest they all come up together, Nolan Mackerel, Brenda Biggs, and Mark Klein. And Mr. Landauer, if you wanted to join them, you'd be welcome there, too.
He doesn't want to.
I'll let you decide the order there.
I'll start. Chair McPherson and members of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear today. For the record, my name is Nolan McCrill. I'm Division Manager of Parking Enforcement with the City of Portland Department of Transportation. I'd like to start out and let you know that we are very supportive of this bill because our officers are out in the field every day from 6:15 in the morning until 11:45 at night. Our officers our daytime officers have the ability to call in to our dispatcher via their two-way radio, and then our swing shift employees use a cell phone to contact the 911 center if they have any emergencies. We've found that through the course of the last few years that the citizens are becoming more agitated and less patient with my staff. They have more verbal encounters, and we have more physical encounters, not leading to injury, but still enough to warrant our officers to be more frightened or more sensitive when they're out in the field working, knowing that a situation could occur without any real warning. This bill would change it from an assault of physical danger or harm to one of my officers or a park ranger to from a misdemeanor to a felony, which would add a little more ability for the police and the district attorney to do some criminal arrest and prosecution if warranted. And it would give our officers a sense of more protection out in the street while performing their job because of added protection within the Oregon statutes. We don't believe that by adding this is going to create a large increase in us wanting to prosecute anybody. It's just adding a level of protection for our officers while they're out working in the field to give them the confidence to know that the law supports the work that they're doing out in the field. I have an officer to testify later to explain what her perspective is out in the field. And I would also like to thank Representative Barker for introducing the bill to, and I would also like to just to offer my support to say that our public employees working out in the field in situations typically alone deserve the protection that they have while performing their jobs. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Mark Klein. I supervise the Park Ranger Program for the Portland Parks and Recreation Bureau. Park rangers really provide a livability, public safety enforcement within the park system, within our community centers, swimming pools, golf courses, and such. We wear an identifiable uniform, but we're not armed, and we are not sworn law enforcement officers. We try to diffuse situations through verbal communication and persuasion. Park rangers have a high public contact level and are concentrated on not only our busy downtown urban parks, but also our natural resource areas that are vast and very remote. We concentrate our training on providing personal safety issues to our rangers, teaching them how to use verbal compliance, and then how to disengage when, in fact, they're in a situation that they feel they may be in trouble. Given that, though, there are times when we're dealing with particularly intoxicated individuals who may not understand that while we want them to comply, we're not in this fight mode. And in those cases, most of the time, we can disengage and get away from. And that's how we instruct our park rangers. If they're at that point where they're in trouble, they need to just walk away. And then we will call the police to gain the compliance that we're after.
Okay. Ms. Biggs?
Yes. Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Biggs, and I'm a parking code enforcement officer with the City of Portland's Office of Transportation. I'd like to thank you today for letting me appear before you and speak on House Bill 2736, which would create the crime of assaulting a parking code enforcement officer. So today I'm going to describe a little bit of my duties and an incident that occurred to me and how this bill would help in that situation. So I'm a walking officer downtown, and I patrol the main business district in downtown Portland. So I enforce parking regulations according to Title 16. It's mostly overtime parking. And I issue approximately an average of 80 tickets a day, and I run into a lot of citizens. And most of the time, the interactions are very good in productive, and I'm able to get information across. But a lot of times, or occasionally, not a whole lot, but occasionally somebody gets really upset with us and we have bad encounters. So one of the incidences that occurred to me, I was patrolling on my regular beat. I had sighted a vehicle earlier in the day and was coming around a second time, and he had moved his car, but he hadn't paid the meter. And he parked right out in front of his restaurant. And so as I was writing the ticket, he comes running out of the business, and he lunged at me and grabbed my handheld and tried to wrestle it away from me, and I carried on a strap across my shoulder. So he grabbed at the machine and pulled me, and I was very afraid of this person and really shaken up. I wasn't able to continue at that point. I did call the police, and they came, and as soon as I called on dispatch for police, the gentleman let go of me, but he continued yelling at me and screaming and calling me names, and people were coming out of the business and kind of joining in, so I was very shaken and frightened by the situation. So I believe that this bill would give us, me and my colleagues, a degree of assurance that those who come out and do use violence against us would get prosecuted for those actions. And I believe that the same protections that are extended to those under the existing assault in the third degree statute should be extended to parking enforcement officers. So I'm not expecting this to be used as a tool for everyday happenings, but when something serious does happen, I would really appreciate seeing people held accountable and having some kind of recourse against these actions. So also thank you for the opportunity to address this issue today, and thank you for your help to establish the protection given within this bill.
And Ms. Biggs, I want to thank you for the work that you do. You do a thankless job. You probably don't get thanked very often for it, and yet it's important to for the orderly operation of our, particularly the center city in Portland, that we have effective parking enforcement. And even though I get an occasional ticket, I don't begrudge it at all.
Thank you.
It's an important function.
Is this official?
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, Mrs. Biggs. And as somebody who was downtown Portland last night at about 6 o'clock on 7th Street trying to... Never mind. I understand how people can get frustrated, and we need to obviously retain those. I'm concerned about this particular situation you described to us. Was that person prosecuted?
The officers that responded, he was not given a ticket or anything. He was basically talked to, and the officers left and was not cited at the time.
Follow up, if I may.
You may.
So we changed the law. How does that change?
Well, if the penalties were a little bit stricter rather than just a misdemeanor, at least possibly the person would have been cited, because it would make it a more serious crime. And even if they plead the case down, it would still at least be a start. It would be something. Currently, there's, like I say, the man wasn't even given a ticket, and he really should have been at least cited. And I think with a more stricter penalty that would happen.
If I may?
Yes.
Well, I guess I'm concerned, and I'm supportive of, obviously, Representative Krieger's not here. He has a lot of trees, for punishment over in his place. I'm supportive of punishment if it's a crime, but if we are not enforcing already, somebody was assaulting you and the policeman didn't even bother to write a citation, we have the police in here asking them why they're not writing the citations when they should be. So I just want to make that point. Thank you.
Chair McPherson, may I follow
Please.
Up with that? Not that the officer, for Representative Cameron, for the officer not being able to do something, they it's a misdemeanor, and if the officers have an ability to know that they have other courses that they could follow, they would look at that. I was talking with Commander Reese in a Central Precinct about that particular question that you had, and that would give the officers, they would give their officers the knowledge to know that this bill gives them additional abilities if something happens, and they can make the determination at the scene if they needed to take the action to go further, or gives them more of an ability to even cite for the misdemeanor than just only having a misdemeanor or nothing. So this would provide the police officers with a little additional ability to determine the risk of the situation.
Any further questions?
And I'd just point out that this event would not rise to felony assault. The event was discussed. The police should have done something, though. I mean, but... This is for physical injury where somebody, if it had gone just the next step, which of course is the concern, that somebody's belligerent like that and then they start beating somebody up. And I know personally I've stopped and helped intervene on things, especially near the courthouse where somebody's already mad because they got convicted in court and they come out, they had to stay in court longer than they planned, they got a ticket, excuse me, or somebody's writing a ticket, and they just go ballistic. And this will help protect and show that the government supports its workers that are out there in the field.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Representative Barker. Do you think that we've looked at all the other professions? In other words, have we covered everyone that should be covered under this, not just park rangers?
We've had it in the past. I think they're pretty well covered, but this was an exception. And people view view them as police, even though they're not armed and so on. Right. But especially the park rangers too. Forest Park in Portland's huge, and that's really isolated.
My question is: do we
want to add anybody else?
Yeah, is there anyone else that we're overlooking? It's my
not that I can think of offhand.
Okay, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCrell, I understand that the intent is to provide some leverage in addressing the situations that would arise to the level of assault. Do you track incidents where you could give us an indication of where you've had actual assaults on your officers, and you give some idea of the scope of those incidents?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Flores, to answer your question, is we just had one of our abandoned auto inspectors who was out to, following up on a case go out to site and tow a vehicle, and a person came out of his house with a pipe, and came after her with the pipe, and she lifted up her arm to deflect the pipe and hit her arm. And with that case, we actually had the police arrest the person after a couple of weeks. He disappeared after that. And they found him, and the district attorney did warrant an assault for that particular violation, only because of using a weapon. But that's something that is not typical. But we do track our circumstances that occur with our officers and abandoned auto inspectors, because we find that the level has increased, and so we wanted to make sure that we keep a track of that. And the verbal assaults are increasing, and the verbal assaults are increasing to pushing or trying to grab the handheld or do something else with our officers. So it is getting, the escalation is growing, and we wanted to have some mechanism to be prepared for that if something serious did occur. We've been very fortunate that we haven't had circumstances that caused physical danger to our officers, but we need to be prepared, knowing, seeing the increase in the agitation and frustration and anxiety that citizens have toward our employees.
For Krill, it is now a Class A misdemeanor to cause injury to a parking attendant, for example. And so I'm wondering, how often is that prosecuted as a Class A misdemeanor? Because the change being proposed here is to elevate it to a Class C felony.
Chairman Pearson, an answer to your question is that it doesn't get prosecuted that frequently as a misdemeanor. Some situations they do get cited, and they do plea it down. But going into a misdemeanor is not a very common occurrence that happens when the police come up and cite them. So the police are very responsive to us. I have to say that when a police officer comes to our aid, they treat us like as one of their officers is needing help, and we appreciate the help they give us. And a lot of times the officer will talk with the person to de-escalate the situation. If the officer feels it's de-escalated enough and they've made their point, then they will they'll end it right there and not even give them a citation for that particular event. If they do cite them for that situation, the district attorney will follow up with that, typically not ever going to any kind of a court case or anything like that.
Okay, if there are no further questions, I'll excuse this panel, and we have Mary Botkin. And Brian, would it make sense for you to join Mary? Yeah, why don't we? But she signed up first, so let's let her go first. But just in the interest of moving the process along, I thought I'd bring you both up.
I'm going to be very brief, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent the folks that you were just talking with, and we don't think you ought to. I don't think anybody ought to be able to beat up our people.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLeishmet, Oregon Council of Police Associations. Although we don't have a representation in this particular employment group, I thought it might be helpful. I was listening to the dialogue, and I heard two questions that I may be a little bit helpful on. The first one was the question about the difference between the misdemeanor and the felony and how it's, in fact, prosecuted, not prosecuted, and carried forward. A little history. Up until about 8 years ago, my organization brought forth at that time a bill that actually elevated from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony the same kind of an assault, physical assault, that resulted in bodily injury of police officers and corrections officers as well. That was done for a couple of reasons. One is to get the attention of the people that are in fact perpetrating these types of assaults. The second was, in some circumstances, in some counties, because of lack of resources, and we fully understood it, DAs were not prosecuting misdemeanors. They would only prosecute a felony. So once it was brought to a felony, in fact, some of the cases did go forward, and ultimately they may have been pled down to a misdemeanor, but in fact it got the attention of the people that needed to get the attention. The second question was from Representative Wisnett, which was, do we now have all the people covered by this kind of a statute? It's my belief that we do. Last session, you may remember, we had a bill that dealt with resisting and assaulting parole and probation officer. We added them. We found out they were not adequately covered in some situations. But we now have police, corrections, parole and probation officers, and these folks as well.
Mr. Chair, if I can, you know, we probably have all the public safety folks covered, but, you know, I just want to remind everybody that as taxi drivers, there are folks who go out to read meters. There, you know, there are a lot of people who access your personal and private property in the course and scope of their duties, and I'm not sure it's possible to capture everybody, you know, that we just don't even think about it. And you know, next session we can have somebody in here talking about PGE meter readers because somebody's mad at PGE. I mean, you know, those are just there are people out there who will do damage to other people, and I don't know that we can always catch them all, but I think we've got all the public safety work sites covered at this point. I agree with Brian about that. I can't think of anybody else.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions for either of these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2736 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2737. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2737 also relates to the crime of assault in the third degree. I previously read a definition of what that crime is. I'll repeat just briefly. ORS 163.165 establishes the Class C felony of assault in the third degree. This offense occurs in several situations, including but not limited to, I'll just share a couple of them, recklessly causing serious physical injury to another by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon, recklessly causing serious physical injury to another under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, or recklessly causing physical injury to another by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. Those are examples of assault in the third degree. House Bill 2737 adds a new category classification for assault in the third degree. If the defendant causes the injury through driving a vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants, then it is a Class B felony, not a Class C felony. House Bill 2737 also specifies that the offense of assault in the third degree through a Dewey situation would be classified as a level 8 on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission sentencing guidelines grid.
Senator Barker, did you want to make some comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We wanted to get this bill a little bit cleaner, the law a little bit cleaner and clearer. In the past, arguing whether some of the and this includes serious physical injury, which is pretty severe injuries. It's not just a bruise or a bump on the head. And there's cases where it was difficult to prove all the parts of the offense. And so people would either get 10 years or they'd get probation, and this kind of levels that out. We want people who, I'm sponsoring the bill because I want people who seriously injure somebody else while driving drunk to be facing a number 8 on the sentencing curve. So that would, and a judge, of course, it would have authority to depart up or down on that. But I think this just makes it clearer, and once again, it's for the drunk drivers that are severely injuring innocent people.
Okay. We have Ann Pratt from Crime Victims United.
Good
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. First of all, I apologize for the ream of paper I just handed to the assistant. There's testimony from our victims who did not come today, Sarah Edwards and her mother, Bonnie Edwards. Sarah was a victim of Assault 3 by an intoxicated driver in 1996. Also, it's testimony from Murray Armstrong, whose son was killed in that same crash. Crime Victims United has asked that Assault 3 be raised to from a 6 to an 8 because the punishment needs to fit the crime. And under the current law, the sentence is 180 days. It would be raised from 16 to 18 months. It does, as Representative Barker said, leave room for judicial discretion in those rare cases where probation is appropriate. And it raises it to a B felony, which allows a more appropriate three-year probationary period. House Bill 2737 actually follows suit with the bill that we passed in 2003 that elevated the crime of criminally negligent homicide while under the influence from an 8 to a 9 on the sentencing grid. DUI assault is a known risk, just as DUI homicide is a known risk. Both are 100% preventable. These criminals know or should have known the dangers, and after 26 years of MAD indoctrinating us and educating us on the risks, there is absolutely no one who does not know the risks. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration estimates the cost of these surviving victims, of surviving serious injury victims, at $108,000. That's just an average. In the first year, Sarah Edwards' care was over $300,000. It took her 5 months to get out of the hospital. The offender in that case was charged with assault 3 and received 90 days for the assault for Sarah. She has severe brainstem injury, and she had a 7% chance of survival. Excuse me. At this point, 11 years later, and since then, the state has paid for her medical treatment and her living expenses. Sarah will never get any better. Her life was basically stolen from her by this drunk driver. Also, on the back of my testimony, you will see a revised version of Sarah's story. So, again, I do apologize for all the paper. I know that your time is limited. We believe if we're ever going to make a difference in society's view of driving under the intoxicants, these 2,000 injuries Oregon accumulates every year, we need to separate and draw attention to it, as we did in criminally negligent homicide, and make the consequences more severe. We believe not only does the punishment fit the crime, but it will create a social deterrent effect. We urge you to please pass this bill. We also have with us today Sergeant Tim Plummer from OSP to answer any law enforcement questions, and also Kristen Snowden from the Multnomah County DA's office. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Ms. Pratt? Thank you very much. Let's have Kirsten Snowden then.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, other committee members. My name is Kirsten Snowden. I'm a Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney. I have been with Multnomah County DA's office for 9 years now. And during those 9 years, I've prosecuted DUII cases. For the past 5.5 years, approximately, I have been with our major traffic department, where we prosecute all of the major assaults and homicides usually associated with drunk driving. I am here, like I was 2 years ago, in support of this bill now called House Bill 2737, because I think that it is an important change to what is now a wide-ranging number of acts that are prescribed by assault in the third degree. As the bill is, as assault in the third degree is currently written, there are 10 separate subsections of conduct that create different types of assault in the third degree. But all of these different 10 subsections are currently level 6 crimes on the sentencing guidelines. And assault in the third degree covers a wide range of criminal behavior, anything from an inmate spitting on a corrections officer to what we've heard about being a drunk driver causing very serious physical injury to someone that could literally mean that they're a quadriplegic or that they have serious brain injuries. These are situations that we see every single day. The reason that I'm here in support of House Bill 2737 is because, as Representative Barker alluded to, there's currently a huge gap in the law. And for some reason, a person who is drunk and driving recklessly, who collides with another car, who causes someone to receive such a severe brain injury that they're in a nursing home for the rest of their lives, that is something that we now say is a level 6 offense, an offense for which most people would receive a probationary sentence and a very short term in jail, usually about 30 days. However, if the same conduct occurs and the victim, instead of having a permanent brain injury that renders them, essentially the equivalent of a child, and instead of that happening, if the person dies, then we have ballot measure 11. And that person is facing manslaughter in the second degree, and they're going to prison for 75 months. I'm here today because that makes no sense. It makes no sense that someone can essentially engage in the same type of conduct, that the ramifications to the victim can be so severe, yet the punishment so disparate. I will let you know that of these 10 subsections in assault in the third degree, there are two only that this bill really affects. It's subsection A and C. Those are the only two subsections that we prosecute people for driving under the influence cases, because in subsection A, that's a situation where someone recklessly causes serious physical injury to another by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon. A car is not a deadly weapon. It is a dangerous weapon under the law. And so this would capture the situation that I just described, a drunk driver driving into oncoming traffic, colliding with another vehicle, and someone in that car loses a limb. The serious physical injury is very severe. It is protracted disfigurement. It is someone who is essentially never going to be the same, someone who will not recover from their injuries. The other subsection that this applies to is someone who recklessly causes physical injury to another by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon, again a car, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. A typical example that we would see that would fall under this subsection, subsection C, would be perhaps the repeat offender, someone who, say, for example, has 4 prior DUI convictions, who's driving 100 miles an hour down the wrong way of the freeway. Unfortunately, these are situations that occur. And this is the subsection that would apply, unless, because if the difference between A and C is the person would not suffer serious physical injury. So say that person who's had 4 prior DUIs and driving the wrong way down the street hits someone and only causes them to have a lacerated head, a broken arm, and a broken leg. That wouldn't be considered serious physical injury. But yet, despite the fact that that person has these prior DUIs, they'd be a level 6 on the grid, and they would be looking at, as I said, probably 30 days jail and probation. Now, this bill would stop that, and only as it relates to subsections A and C would it elevate the crime of assault in the third degree to a level 8. I know that this bill failed 2 years ago. The fiscal impact was deemed to be too large. I can't pretend to know how Ways and Means goes about determining the fiscal impact, but My concern is that it's not being done properly because there are 10 different subsections of assault in the third degree, and even within subsections A and C, so few of the cases overall would be vehicular cases. So I can't speak to that. I'm skeptical as to whether or not this bill has the fiscal impact that Ways and Means thinks that it does, but I think that it's a very important bill, and it's difficult to explain to someone who's had their lives changed forever. I remember the testimony last time of Sarah Edwards, and her mother was just the most heartbreaking example of this, because not only did Sarah lose much of her life, but so did her mother, because her mother cares for her 24 hours a day. And to think that somebody could just go to jail for 30 days, where if she were to die, they'd be in prison for a very long period of time, makes no sense. So because of that, I strongly, personally support this bill. My office supports this bill, and I hope that you will, too.
Thank you, Ms. Snowden. So the effect of the bill, if I'm following what you were just explaining to us, is to elevate a DUII case that involves serious physical injury from a Class C felony to a Class B felony.
Correct. And it would also correspondingly elevate the crime seriousness from a Level 6 to a Level 8. So depending on, you know, if someone has robbery convictions, they would already be looking at prison. Typically, your average drunk driver isn't also a robber. They're just someone who is a danger to the community in a different way, where they're out repeating drinking and driving and putting others at risk. So if you look at a level 6, someone that would normally be in the 90 to 180 day range. 180 days is not jail time. That upper box is for other, like, community service units. But that would, they would go from 30 days jail to 16 to 18 months in prison if they have no criminal history.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Snowden. And I have a question about the cases that were brought to us, the Sarah Edwards case. And I wasn't here before. I'm a freshman, so I don't have the benefit of all that testimony. I thought somebody did die in that collision, and so was not the defendant incarcerated for the death of the other person in the car?
You know, Ms. Pratt would need to speak to that, because I don't know the circumstances of that case. It was in another county. But typically you're correct. And quite frankly, as a prosecutor, you know, if somebody dies, well, at least we think we can send the person to prison and protect other people. But really, this bill is aimed at situations where nobody does die, where they're seriously injured, and it just doesn't make sense that there'd be such a disparate consequence for the same conduct.
And a follow-up, which is actually more of a comment than a question. We had a bill here recently that has to do with the ignition devices. What are they called?
Interlock ignition
devices. And I tell you, I really support that, and I hope we can get that passed, because if we can prevent these things from happening rather than just increasing the penalties, we're all better off.
I agree.
Any further questions?
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Snowden. But those are all our sign-ups. Is there anyone else who wanted to present on House Bill 2737? Okay, very good. Then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2737. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2939. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2939 provides that correction officers acting within the scope and authority of their employment have the same powers and duties as peace officers. Briefly, ORS 181.610 sub 5 defines a corrections officer as an officer who primarily performs, quote, the duty of custody, control, or supervision of individuals convicted of or arrested for a criminal offense and confined in a place of incarceration or detention other than a place used exclusively for incarceration or detention of juveniles, close quote. Put simply, corrections officers manage and control people that are in custody, not the juveniles. They do not necessarily have all the powers and authority of other peace officers, i.e., I'm specifically talking about the power to detain folks, the power to arrest folks. What House Bill 2939 does is it specifies that corrections officers do have, indeed, all of those powers. Any powers and immunities that peace officers have, corrections officers have, if they're acting within the scope and course of their employment as with the Department of Corrections.
Okay. This is Representative Barker. Did you want to make any introductory comments on this bill?
The intent of this bill was to allow corrections officers who are working in the visitation area when a visitor comes in and has drugs or something, so they could make an arrest on site. That was the intent.
Very good. We have Mitch Morrow signed up. Well, I beg your pardon, Mitch. Ms. Morrow, you're signed up in opposition to this bill, right?
That's correct.
So why don't we hear from proponents first?
Right.
And I'm assuming that Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me today are Officer Carrillo, who works at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. Oh, I'm sorry. Corporal Carrillo. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And Tim Woolery. And Tim had a glorious career at Sandy Am up until he joined our staff as one of our union officials. And so I've asked both of them to talk today, but just by way of background, several issues have been brought to me over the years in relationship to corrections employees, and one of the most compelling arguments that have been made is that the officers are limited under the scope and authority of their status in law to detain or hold visitors and or civilians who are passing potentially dangerous contraband to inmates. This occurs in the visiting rooms, and it also occurs with work crews. Probably the most prevalent contraband that is passed through is tobacco, because it is a legal substance outside of the corrections environment. Tobacco products are strictly banned on all corrections property. And, you know, it used to be that they were passing drugs, marijuana and other drugs. Now, the more prevalent one is tobacco, and tobacco is very valuable inside the institutions. And so the problem is that officers who know that contraband or activity that is illegal is occurring have no authority to detain a civilian. And it has been explained to me by some that officers could actually be guilty of kidnapping, because my immediate response was, well, they have to go out through a sally port. Can't it just break for a while until local law enforcement can arrive? Obviously, they can't do that. But the problem is that illegal activities are occurring, and our officers have no ability to stop the illegal activities. And then Corporal Carrillo and Mr. Woolery can both talk about some of the other limitations, and Mr. Woolery can talk about past practices, because I think there has been some inconsistency in the department depending on who the director is at the time. So with that, I will sort of step back and respond to any questions that I can answer.
Why don't we hear from the others, and then we can take questions of the whole panel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Carrillo. As Ms. Bompkin said, I'm a corporal with the Oregon Department of Corrections, currently working over at Coffee Creek. We are the state's only female prison, and we are also the intake center for the whole department. So everybody who comes into our state custody comes through our doors, with the exception of death row inmates. A little bit of the history is there were times way back when we didn't even have training, we didn't even wear uniforms. Times have progressed. We now have DPSST training. We're certified. We go through the same corrections academy that the counties go through. I was side by side with members of Washington County Sheriff's Office, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. We now have uniforms. That being the same, the counties have peace officer status. There are many correlations between the counties and us, or there's correlations between peace officers and us. We have the same retirement as the peace officers. We're allowed to use our agency address on our registration and our driver's license, as do peace officers. We are held to a code of ethics and a code of conduct, as are peace officers. ORS 181-640 sets minimum standards for law enforcement, which again includes corrections officers. ORS 166-260 exempts peace officers from ORS 166-250, which is carrying a concealed firearm. DOC mandates 40 hours of annual in-service training, which includes firearm training and defensive tactics training. We go through that every year. We also have our own TERT team, our tactical response team, who goes through very specific and rigid training. Part of their arsenal are submachine guns. Part of why we want this is to be part of a bigger picture. We want to be part of Homeland Security. With everything going on, there's no reason with all the training that we have, our scope should be so limited. When I was going through the website for Homeland Security, there's training opportunities for either little or no cost if you're a peace officer. FEMA has training, direct training for state and local jurisdictions that enhance capacity and preparedness. There may be some federal grants that we may qualify for. Department of Homeland Security also has federal grants for equipment and training for first responders. Last year in 2006, Department of Homeland Security allocated almost $18 million to the state of Oregon for these training and equipment. So I only had a few hours to prepare for this. I don't know if we would qualify, but these are areas that we may end up getting federal funds to help enhance the department. There are over 2,000 employees in the Department of Corrections. And while we're having trouble funding state police, we could easily add multiple professionally trained people that are out on the street. I'm not talking about patrol, but we do take vacations. H.R. 218 that President Bush signed a few years ago exempts peace officers from carrying concealed weapons across state lines. So on the bigger picture, we're looking at the Homeland Security. With that, if any of you haven't taken a tour of any of the correction facilities, I would invite you to do so. And I would personally consider it a privilege to take you through Coffee Creek. So thank you for your time.
And Corporal, actually, we took a tour of the Coffee Creek facility in, I think, the second week of session back in January, and it was very informative, and we appreciate the hospitality the department showed us.
Thank you, sir.
Next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Woolery. I was a correctional officer with the Department of Corrections for 18 years. Last August, I moved over to start my next career working with AFSCME. During my time at Department of Corrections, I was a work crew supervisor for approximately 8 years. There was multiple instances where citizens would try to drop off materials, contraband, tobacco, drugs, and other things for the inmates, and I had no authority to intervene, question, detain, no authority whatsoever. I also worked in the visiting room and in the gatehouse, which is the place where the citizens check in to go through there. There was multiple times where we had questions whether or not people were under the influence or possibly bringing in contraband, and we had no authority to make any effect. So this bill would take a step in the right direction. I'm in support of it.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Vollery. Any questions for this panel? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for being here. I have a question, excuse me, about your training, and I know Corporal Morello, you talked about it a little bit. What I'm wondering is there's corrections officer training and there's peace officer training. What do peace officers, what training do they have that corrections officers do not currently get?
Well, there's a corrections certification, and then there's a police officer, actually, certification. The corrections, like for the counties, Clackamas County, Washington County, Multnomah County, their corrections deputies that go through the same academy that I go through are peace officers. I'm also a reserve of Clackamas County for the sheriff's office. So, I mean, I know this because I interact with them. So the training is the same. And so the state is spending all this money on us, our continued our training every year, but yet there's rewards that they could be reaping that they're not. Their money could be better spent. Did that answer your question, ma'am?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. A couple questions now. The contraband issue. So if somebody is in the prison, you have no authority to do anything to stop them from passing the contraband so we just let it happen? Is that what I'm hearing?
Our authority is over the inmates, not citizens. We would intervene, obviously, if we see something going on, but our activities would be geared toward the inmate, not the citizen. We would be escorting the citizen off premises. We'd be calling state police, but state police, as you know, is busy. They probably wouldn't be able to arrive before that person was able to leave.
So at this, follow up if I may. So at this time, we would stop the contraband from being passed through. The issue here is whether that person who did it would be arrested or not for doing it. But they would be eliminated. You have the authority to eliminate them from the premise and then and in the future, correct? They go on a list?
That's true. We could revoke their visitation privileges.
Okay, and then the second question, it comes back to the training. Do corrections officers go through the same 16-week training that police officers do?
No, they do not. They have a 5-week course, the same as the counties. Some counties have peace officer status. The training that our state correction employees go through is the exact same thing that the counties do, and it's actually geared more towards county corrections than state at the current time.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Chair.
We will now hear from, let's hear from Mitch Morrow.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Morrow. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Corrections. I'll be brief, and I'll start out by saying we are correctional officers, not police officers. Our job is corrections, and on behalf of the agency, I would want you to know that we're not interested in doing police work. We work with police officers. We bring them into our institutions. We call them to work sites. Wherever we need them to assist us, we use them. This bill causes us some concern in different areas. If we find ourselves with peace officer status, potentially the inmates, when they learn that, will begin to force us through litigation to have to Mirandize them before we talk to them. Today we search their cells. We interview them. If we run into criminal elements, we immediately contact the state police. But if we find ourselves having to Mirandize inmates or get warrants to search cells or to review mail or to listen to phone calls, which we use every day to manage our institutions in a safe and secure manner, I think our world becomes very complicated. We absolutely believe that the training that our staff receive, which is the 5 weeks, is enough. The police officers go through the 16 weeks, which was pointed out, and the county correctional officers equally go through the 5 weeks. If they move to an active deputy role or they become a road officer, I believe then the training expands to the 16 weeks that is needed or required to be certified as a police officer. So with that, I would tell you also that on a personal note, I worked in the institutions most of the time in uniform, some 20 years, and I can't think of a single instance where I needed police authority to do my job. And I started out as a correctional officer and worked my way up through the uniform ranks, most of that being at the penitentiary. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions, Mr. Morrow? Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Mr. Morrow, what about the testimony towards the Homeland Security issues and the benefit to that? Or let me ask first question. If there is an attempt to pass contraband today, from your perspective, how is that handled? And are there arrests made of those people who are trying to pass that type of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it all depends on the circumstances. I have been involved in cases where we understood contraband through our intelligence gathering, again, through review of the mail and listening to the phone calls and so forth, where we knew contraband was on its way into our institutions. We would coordinate with the state police and make an arrest on site. But again, our job was then to deal with the inmate, and it was the police authority's job to deal with the civilian.
And follow up, if I may, on the issue of the Homeland Security. Do you have any input on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know enough about it to comment on it. I do know that through our emergency preparedness activities within the agency, we are in contact with Homeland Security folks, but I don't know to what depth. We are a public safety entity, so those conversations occur. To what level, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Question of wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morrow, thank you. Could you explain, I had two questions, the difference between the testimony we previously heard that county correction officers are treated as peace officers and your personnel are not? And second, can you tell us how do other states, or do other states give correctional officers powers and immunities as peace officers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure about which counties do and don't. I don't know why they'd make that designation, so I'd have a difficult time answering that. My understanding from the state perspective, there's about 7 states that grant peace officer status, which means there's 40 plus that don't. I will give you an example, and again, this is somewhat based on limited experience. In California, for example, if the correction they actually are considered police officers and have arrest authority, it's very expensive for that state. There is a slippery slope you find yourself on, because once you begin to give your staff the powers of a police officer, then you have to train them as a police officer, which means then you find yourself on the path of certifying them at that level. So it becomes very complicated. They do have to issue warrants down there. They do have to do the very things that I talked about, and it becomes very complicated for their system. And quite frankly, I'd much rather have the Oregon system than the California system. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for those comments. If certain counties are doing it, what authority, but we don't have this legislation, are they using to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have no idea. I don't know, sir.
It's a problem.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moore, I'm concerned about the interpretation about requiring the Miranda rights. Is that something that you think might happen, or do you have some sort of legal basis for that? Has somebody told you that that's going to happen if this bill passes?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not an attorney. We have worked with the Department of Justice, and those concerns were provided to us. I don't think there's been a lot of legal research around that perspective specifically, so I'm not quite certain where it would go. Here's what I do know for sure. Once the inmate population knew that we were peace officers, I guarantee you the litigation that would come from that would push us to the courts to define what it is our role can be if we have this particular status.
Thank you.
Let's excuse Mr. Morrow. And Mr. DeLashman, I'm going to bring you up, even though you weren't signed up here. Just it sounds like you had relevant information here.
Again, Brian DeLashman, Oregon Council of Police Associations, Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Listening to the dialogue, I thought maybe I might be helpful on the question about what other counties do and how do they give that authority. My understanding, and I believe this is the parallel to parole and probation officers, those officers are deputized as deputy sheriffs in those districts or those counties. Therefore, they have the rights and responsibilities of a peace officer. So the same, this parallel issue, and you have one of my bills dealing with peace officers and the ability to intersect with a non-parolee when they witness the same kind of crimes. It's a parallel issue that you're talking about here, but it's my understanding that the other counties, in fact, in some cases, do extend the peace officer status via deputizing those correctional folks.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. DeLashman. Last person signed up is Amy Okonich, and I have a request from Andrea Meyer to join her as well. So,
good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Amy Okonich here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'll try to make my testimony brief because most of our points have already been made, although, frankly, I kind of like some of what I heard, which is the needing warrants to search cells and having to Mirandize inmates, but that's a whole separate issue. We do not support this bill. We oppose it, frankly, because the Department of Corrections do not receive the same training as police officers, and to provide them with the same privileges and immunities is extraordinarily concerning to us. And I got even more concerned when the testimony was that these are people who would be out on the street or on vacation and using those their new kind of title in some fashion, although I can't imagine what fashion they would be using it, although I know being on vacation was referenced. That's incredibly concerning for us. They receive substantially less training than police officers do, and to confer on them those same rights raises a whole host of issues, most of which were already discussed. We do think if there's a very small problem, which is that people in visitation are passing contraband, that this bill is too broad, it affects too much. I tried to do some research on the immunities section of this, because I know that we haven't had much testimony on what that is. And my understanding, although I'm not a civil attorney, is that that would also make these individuals immune from prosecution in certain instances. I don't know what the liability issues are for that. I don't know what the costs are for that. I'm concerned about providing the immunity to corrections officers that peace officers have when peace officers have so much more training and are much more skilled in arrests and interrogation and searches, and they know they're a little bit more familiar with the law. We have some of the same concerns that Department of Corrections, like I said, about the Miranda and inmates being able to force litigation, although, like I said, we have it on the flip side, which is what these officers can be immune to. We oppose this bill. If corrections officers would like to go through the same training as police officers, then we would, you know, withdraw our opposition. And with that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Okonich. Ms. Meyer.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm just here to echo the same concerns raised by OCDLA and in the past sessions and potentially in this session. ACLU has testified with concerns whenever there is an attempt by folks to step up their authority with carrying weapons and other things without the sufficient equal training as law enforcement peace officers. So consistent with that and the concerns raised, we do oppose House Bill 2939 and would urge you not to move forward. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. If they were trained the full 16 weeks, would you oppose them being on vacation, carrying their firearms across state lines?
Representative Cameron, members of the committee, if they receive the same level of training, I would think I'd have a very difficult time opposing them being given the same rights and immunities. I don't speak for the Department of Corrections, though, but I would have a difficult time opposing that.
And Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, off the top of my head, I'm not ready to say that we would not oppose that. You've had legislation that's been pulled from hearing about Portland State, you know, police off turning our corrections folks, or not corrections, excuse me, but the security guards at Portland State and even giving them the same treatment. And our concerns, even if they had the same training, would still arise turning in our campuses to sort of with armed police and that whole precedent there. So in line with that, I would want to consider other factors about turning these folks into ostensibly police officers and whether that's the appropriate situation for what they're trained to do and what they should be doing. So I can't commit to that being the cure. That's certainly one of the components we've always raised concerns about as a threshold, and then we need to look at other factors.
Representative Cameron?
Ms. Meyer, based on the events of this week, maybe we need to have armed campus police.
That is another bill that was not ready because of recent events to come to hearings, but may welcome to return to our agenda. I will, if there's no further question then for this panel, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2939 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3155.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3155 comes to you from Representative Barker. Appropriates a yet-to-be-determined sum of money to the Oregon Department of Justice for the biennium beginning July 1, 2007 of the General Fund to be distributed to the Oregon District Attorneys Association for the purpose of paying the salary and executive director for the association. Chair, members of the committee, you may see in line 6 the bill has a blank next to the dollar sign, and this bill has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Very good. And I have no one on the sign-up list, but I think, Mr. Neely, you are going to present on this.
3155.
Representative Barker used up his bills.
Oh, I'm sorry. And actually, Representative Barker, did you want to make an introductory comment on this?
Mr. Neely.
Representative Barker Committee.
Are they?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. And Representative Barker, thank you for allowing us to introduce this bill. House Bill 3155, for the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. House Bill 3155, by way of background, is part of our work with the governor on the establishment of the governor's recommended budget. The governor's recommended budget does, in fact, fund an executive director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. It also funds another position that currently is housed at the Oregon Department of Justice that ostensibly manages the Oregon District Attorneys Association at this time. One of the reasons that we have introduced this legislation is we were making an effort to find a way to have an executive director without creating a whole new agency, and this is the mechanism by which legislative counsel suggested we go about doing that. A little bit of history about the Oregon District Attorneys Association and the notion of having an executive director. 20 years ago, this association did, in fact, have an executive director position, and that executive director handled the day-to-day operations of the association, which include a number of functions that are required by the state. Principally among those, development of the Oregon District Attorney's budget and management of all of the associated budget work, including payroll, those sorts of things. Right now, all of that is handled not by the District Attorney's Association. It's generally handled by the Department of Justice, and for that, the Oregon District Attorneys, who have no agency, pay a fee. So we're trying to, again, provide some basic structure for the District Attorneys that will give them consistency, continuity, and an ability to manage the important work they do. So I've handed you some written testimony. In that written testimony, I've really highlighted why we believe there needs to be an executive director position. I'm not going to go through all of the details that are in that. You can see them there in front of you. I would highlight the two most important ones from our viewpoint are one, which I just mentioned, and that is a continuity. Right now, what happens with the district attorneys is the budget for the district attorneys, again, it's a state budget. It's crafted by whomever the president of the District Attorneys Association is for the even-numbered year. So in 2006, one district attorney crafts it, and then a new district attorney is elected president the following year, and that district attorney then has to come to the legislature and talk about it. And then the following year, a new district attorney steps in, and that district attorney is responsible for crafting a new budget. And what I would tell you is under the bylaws of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, no district attorney can serve as president twice. So never has a district attorney handled the budget twice. So each and every time we have to reinvent the wheel. This would keep us from having to do that. Additionally, the other key component that the District Attorneys Association handles is the statewide training for all deputy district attorneys. Again, there is no continuity year to year. We do have an employee at the Department of Justice who handles the actual implementation of the trainings, but who speaks at the trainings, the content of the trainings, that's decided by the president of the association, who has to take time away from his or her prosecutorial schedule to make all those determinations over the course of the year. Again, there's no continuity. My request to the committee is that you move this bill out of here. It has another stop, certainly, and that's downstairs in Ways and Means. Our budget hearing is next week. I'll see at least two of you down there next week to talk about this in more detail. The District Attorneys Association strongly supports this bill. I suspect there have been many occasions this session when they'd have preferred to have an ED here instead of just me, but hopefully we can get there for next session. Again, this is a very good bill. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Our hope is that you would send us down to Ways and Means for deliberation during our budget.
Well, Mr. Neely, lacking an executive director, I think you're doing a fine job on behalf of our district attorneys, but I can understand they might want a more regular staffing. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Neely. You mentioned in your written testimony that ODAA has the smallest staff of any such organization in the United States. Do other states fund executive directors or fund associations of district attorneys similar to what this request would do?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, yes, they do. In 37 other states, there is a prosecutorial association that is funded by the state. And most states have an amalgam of funding, much like Oregon has. Here in Oregon, right now at least, the only portion of DA funding that is paid for by the state is the actual DA salaries. That's changed over time. And in other states, there may be a that's often the case in most states, is the DA's salary. DAs are state employees and their salary is paid by the state. But the deputies, there's various amounts of funding that goes for those deputies. I can give you some examples. One example, Kentucky. They have a prosecutorial association. They have 17 state employees for that association. These associations often handle a important volume of doing things like brief banks, so that each individual district attorney's association or district attorney's office doesn't have to have their own brief bank. They can go back to a centralized brief bank. Often IT functions are centralized in these organizations. That's one of the things we asked the governor to do this session. We'll talk a lot about that in our Ways and Means presentation. It hasn't happened. So the short answer to your question is there are the vast majority of states already have funded positions, just as the one we're asking for.
Thank you, Mr. Neely.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neely, I'm sure that this will come up in Ways and Means testimony, but the $382,000, is that for a executive director and a secretary? And what happens to the DOJ FTE? Does that transfer over and that money is subtracted from the DOJ budget?
Representative McPherson, Representative Wisman, members of the committee, the answer is that $380,000 is the biennial cost of the executive director position. We also will be moving over the operations, the policy and operations manager that is currently at the Department of Justice. The funding from that position shifts to the Oregon District Attorneys Association and out of the Department of Justice, so it's a zero-sum game.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So my colleague and I, so that's salary only for one position?
I think that's a good question, Representative Wisnett. Chair McPherson, member of the committee. No, it's salary and all of the other costs associated with the organization.
And it is a two-year figure.
It's biennially, so that's over the course of 2 years.
Well, that was my question. It's not just salary. It's the office operation, the phones, and the...
Well, what I was hearing was it's salary and benefit.
It's also cost. Supplies and services. All of that fits into the budget number.
So it's a $90,000 job. You have a lot of DAs applying. And judges.
Salary and costs of employing an executive director.
That's right. Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, this is a... This position right now is budgeted at a PEMF, and that's a standard manager in most mid-level agencies. So we looked, and in fact, we sought higher amount because we thought this person maybe ought to be required to be an attorney. we've backed off that so we could reduce the cost of this on the state.
Greg?
Just one follow-up then. The general fund appropriation is, are you looking at transferring the fees that are now going to the Department of Justice to support this operation? That would be in the future budgets, I'm assuming.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, that currently isn't in the proposed budget shift. I think, and we've had a number of conversations with the Department of Justice about that, I think that's a discussion we'll have vigorously when we go downstairs next week and talk about this.
I'll pass it. Thank you.
I assume it's, well, that's great. And this executive director, would they be employed within the Department of Justice, or would they be employed and answerable directly to the district attorneys?
Mr. Chair, that's the $25,000 question, and let me tell you how this played out. It turns out, and I just learned this, our concern was we wanted this employee, and actually we wanted the employee who's currently at DOJ to want to retain her PERS account. She's only got a few years left. She's been with the association for over 20 years. We wanted to retain her PERS account, and so we thought we had to do an entire new agency. It turns out that you can, in fact, have non-state employees or county or public employees who are eligible for PERS. That's why we have this bill in front of you right now, in part. League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties are examples of organizations that serve only public employees and are therefore entitled to offer PERS benefits. So this ODAA would then serve just as those League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties would serve in the same manner. This person would be an employee of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. Their hiring and firing decisions would be made by the executive director, or by the president and the executive committee of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. And that, again, has been negotiated with the governor's office over how can we manage the responsibility for hiring this individual. So it's... That's a great question. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neely, thank you, and I realize this does go on to the scope that you'll be presenting in Ways and Means, but when we talk about costs of employing, salary, benefits, you said supplies, does that include an office location as well?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, there are embedded in the S&S costs, the service and supply costs of this employee, are the costs associated with office space. We've been in discussions again with the Department of Justice. Currently, the employee who serves as the kind of the figure who manages ODAA, she has an office at the Department of Justice. I think that's one of the things that we would work out if this package gets funded ultimately by the legislature. One of the questions that we'll need to answer is, do we go actually move another employee into the Department of Justice with the good graces of the Attorney General who we've been talking to about this, or do we just go find a two-room or a one-room office somewhere and house it separately? Those are determinations that haven't been made yet. I think that those will be, if passed, my preference would be those are decisions that the District Attorneys Association makes. They'll have a budget. They'll know what their budget is, and they can't exceed it.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3155 and open a work session on House Bill 3155. Committee, there's obviously a budget issue in this, which is for the Ways and Means Committee to resolve. But it does seem to me that our district attorneys should have more regular support for the functions that they perform, which are because it's important that they be sufficiently supported and that they be coordinated across the state rather than kind of being too isolated in what they do. So I think that that's a policy matter. Providing this kind of support and assistance would be a desirable thing to do, given that we have the Ways and Means function that has to come up with the dollars. So just an introductory comments on my part. Any other thoughts?
Mr. Chair, being on Ways and Means and looking at the salary and all the details, I know that that'll be a big discussion down there of how that goes, and I do agree with you. This is a policy decision here that do we want to support our DAs and have some way that they can have some organization through the state. Sounds like it might even lead to more efficiencies and from other models that were described today. So,
very good. So we have then House Bill 3155 before us. It has, of course, a notable blank in it, but that's what the Ways and Means is charged to do, is to come up with that number. Do I hear a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3155.
With the due pass, and then for, and then to Ways and Means by prior reference.
With a due pass to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3155 with a due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll. House Bill 3155 moves with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll call the, close the work session on 3155. And if I could just hold you for another couple minutes here, committee, on House Bill 3420, I got passed a note that about people who had, didn't realize we had taken it out of order, and I see that Paul Snyder and Ken Armstrong had volunteered to present. Mr. Snyder, did you want to do that now? Let me and Mr. Armstrong. Well, I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3420.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for taking our testimony this morning. As to House Bill 3420, I've had a conversation with Mr. Dole, and I understand that he has proposed amendments. I've seen his hand engrossed version of the measure, and it seems to satisfy the issues that I had, one of which was cost. I understand that his proposal is that it would be funded in the Secretary of State's budget and would not therefore constitute a cost to counties to conduct that audit. And those were the primary issues that we had.
Mr. Chair, Ken Armstrong with the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. I was here primarily to respond to any of the presentation on amendments which we have not seen yet, but which we understand are forthcoming. Juvenile directors don't have a position on the bill other than, like Mr. Snyder, to be somewhat concerned about how the costs are going to play out, make sure that if the costs are going to be borne by the Secretary of State's office, great. Concerned that there not be any cost that would be associated with the county juvenile departments. And then if there might be some relationship cost-wise to the Oregon Youth Authority, how that ends up playing out. And that's a little bit uncertain right now. But I do understand that there are amendments coming, and we look forward to reviewing those and providing comment at that time.
Very good. Any questions for either Mr. Snyder or Mr. Armstrong? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
I'll close
the hearing on House Bill 3420. Committee, that concludes our agenda for today. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.